Can we please get a huge, huge round of applause for Leanne Averbeck?
Guesstimate how tall you are.
Is that good? Is that good? I'll launch right in. For most of the 70s, I was a serious left-wing activist, and during which time I became intimate with the innards of numerous factories and a few jail cells. I earnestly pursued the proletarian revolution in Canada, and at least I got a few good stories out of it. And this one recounts a day in a slaughterhouse on the kill floor. And it's entitled Abattoir. From somewhere over there, the monotonous people screams of pigs are cut with pops, innocent as firecrackers. Nothing much from the cows, the stoics, who swallow their fear with soft oboe moans. I've been sent to the kill floor for a special task, 10,000 sealed packs of bologna forgotten and spoiled. A few of us are chosen, assigned to crouch around the pit and empty the units of meat one by creamy one. But after an hour, only two of us have not run off to empty ourselves. The stench, having nowhere to go, crawls into my mouth while my eyes and ears get busy arguing ontology. Without their hair, save a few sprigs missed by the flame gun, animals have no race. Beneath their browns, reds, and calicos, they're all plain as white men, severely deformed white men, best to eat them. The freshly deceased. Slung cheek to cheek, they glide overhead on hooked tracks, spilling onto the beetle heads of men. My meat mate and I work silently, avoid the hazards of open mouths, toss the rotten meat into the hole for dog food, fertilizer. Across the gorge, a face beneath a hairnet, the rubbery surface of her skin now thick with the oily atmosphere, and that hard hat spilling red from above and down her neck like mine. The woman on the other side works out the day with me until at last the sudden boorish beauty of the horn whistle. It urges us to the exit. The bang of the card clock triggers talk about the blue glow and beer to come as hard hats and smocks, purple with brushstrokes from flesh, weave out through the less soiled incoming shift. So, referring to that era of my life, but many decades down the road, I wrote this. My youth machine rolled, smoked to its stub. Tales of my youth are a big hit at parties. The arrest, cops cleaving me to their sedan. Caught red-handed, skin of newsprint bearing the image of a living Mao laid tenderly on a metal pole. Then the cell, its plain cavity. The beefy women in uniform watching me bathe through a slit. I forget to mention the bulb that buzzed above the narrow cell cot, shredding my brain into a bell jar of worms, the best of them lacking all conviction. Or a ceiling stain the shape of a slow sob. outside the prison gates. Headlines waited like friends who knew me as a child. Comrade so-and-so valiantly defies fascist police, and so on. The quicksand of celebrity. How important I must be. The next 8 years, a fugue of factory jobs, the chairman's words, a chain of smokes in my pocket. Decades later, Mao's personal physician reported the chairman had enjoyed, after a dip in the Yangtze, to bathe in the vaginal fluids of virgins. He shared with Marlon Brando a grotesque eating disorder and a taste for servile foreign women. I had always liked Marlon, too, his sensitive mouth. So, poets get a bad rap, oftentimes, and I'm not referring to that noxious so-called editorial piece that appeared in the National Post recently, but rather that we're often accused of being preoccupied with sex and relationships. So in response to that, I set out to write a piece that was patently unsexy, and it's titled Unsexy. A genuine surprise in bed last night while reading a poem by Frank O'Hara, something about destroying another's idea of himself in order to seduce him, reminded me how unsexy sex can be. Like in 69, I was selling flowers in nightclubs, having dropped out. University seemed so pointless. And I remember this one bar where the floors were sticky, everything was sticky, and nothing stuck to the women on the platforms in cages. And it was welfare check day, and one guy with a sort of rotting face looked at me wistfully, said, "Here," and handed me $20 for a rose. But then later at a very happening venue, a guy with a manicure waited for the nickel back on a 95-cent flower. And afterwards, in the company van, we drop-out flower chicks got high on the boss's smoke to laugh off the feel of all the men and the world of men, and the boss whipped out his dick. Memorable, too, was a man when I was 10. He invited me into the bushes to see his underpants. I remember how nice he seemed, so much sadder than my crazy Aunt Rose, who got married at 15 with a brown suitcase and rules for spits at the evil eye. And she spat when I tried to tell her about the underpants, you see. She was watching me while my parents were in Vegas watching Showgirls. Probably in cages. I think it must have been even earlier. My friend and I were torturing my little cousin in the basement, took off all her clothes and wrote on her, perhaps my first lines, with all the lipstick from our mother's vanities. When the phone rang, it was my Aunt Dora calling little cousin home for dinner, and my poetry was published. And to this day, I never feel anything I write is ready. Much later, I remember friends visiting and my ex-husband's large balls, when he was still my husband, sort of peeking from his summer shorts like kiwis growing in Canada when he crossed those great legs, and my feeling disgust and pride both, like a full-blown argument for later therapy court. Why I had stuck it out so long. And then that hypnotherapist in 86 who wanted me to act it all out with feeling, proponent of the Lee Strasberg School of Behavioral Psychology that he was, twice a week for a month or two, just the two of us on his lush and, he thought, irresistible Persian rug. Thank you.
Yeah, so tell me about the National Post article that you were referring to.
There was
a really virulent article in the National Post recently denouncing the selection of Dion Brand for the poetry mascot of Toronto and the poet laureate of the city. And it was a very...
The mascot's his language? Or?
No, I'm saying that. I was looking for the word. But it's a very sort of uninformed, aggressive attack on poetry and the world of poetry and is challenging. It's many people reacted to it, but the chosen responses to it vary, which is great. I mean, people were very upset by it, but it comes from a position of ignorance about poetry and the significance of poetry, and it was a very ugly attack.
Well, which leads to, I guess, the next question that mm-hmm. you were talking about being involved in a lot of social activism
right.
back then,
mm-hmm.
And then I was wondering, okay, do you still kind of take a stand? And it sounds like you still do.
Well, I mean, I'm an active humanitarian. I get involved in politics to the extent that I have strong opinions, and I get involved with local issues, as well as when I was in the U.S., I was very actively involved in the election of the new president because I believed that was an important choice for the country. So I am active, but I am more, rather than being left-leaning, defined by any ideology, I'm actually anti-ideological. My shoulders go up around my ears when I hear anything that is organized, formulaic thinking about anything. And that comes from my many years being involved in left-wing politics, and I grew to have a healthy distrust of anything that was formulaic in terms of assessing the world. So when I was a teenager, I wanted to write poetry, but then I got drawn into the whole left-wing thing in all of my 20s. And then when I got out of it, I did a lot of other things. And it was only quite recently that the last decade, that I started writing seriously, and it feels much truer to who I am than what I did back in the 70s.
My next poem was inspired by an article, a startling article in The New Yorker by Philip Gombrowicz, who wrote an amazing book during the genocide in Rwanda, but this was a follow-up piece charting the remarkable changes that are going on in Rwanda under the leadership of Paul Kagame, and who's successfully guiding a process of national healing and forgiveness and integration of the Hutu and Tutsi, despite the horrific acts committed by neighbor upon neighbor. Apology, Rwanda, 2009. It's just that if you look at the world, you get a stain that won't come out, a kind of marbled beauty. It's that the genocidaire was forgiven by the Tall family. It's that the earth is a vast, dumb orb of love and confusion, and time blows and blows us its staccato kisses. It's just that each of us begins as a female, then gets on with it. It's that the great slow heron swooped so near the apology in the village, the sun searing its scar inside the sky. And at the tribunal, the elevator enclosed the rough moment like a fast-action flower. It's that justice is fragments dreaming in full sentences. and the business of the casualties was analyzed closely, never asking, what's the point of the pond's reflection at moonless midnight? It's just that they make forgiveness hard to believe, after all. After all, reply the living, luminous in their cottons, all is glass, all belief. Thank you.